In 1963, John McCain sat in a North Vietnamese prison, his only news coming from propaganda broadcasts designed to break his spirit. Years later, after his release, McCain would find David Halberstam's The Best and the Brightest most illuminating about how America had stumbled into Vietnam. The tragedy wasn't just asking men to suffer for a poorly supported cause. It was that our leaders fundamentally misjudged everything. The enemy's determination, American power limits, our allies, and themselves. These weren't ordinary men making these catastrophic errors. They truly were America's intellectual elite, extraordinarily intelligent, educated, and capable. Yet their confidence exceeded their vision, breeding a fatal hubris that would cost America dearly in both blood and national confidence. How could such brilliant minds lead us into such disaster? The answer lies in understanding how intelligence without wisdom becomes dangerously self-deceptive. On a cold December day in 1960, President-elect Kennedy sought Robert Lovett's guidance on assembling a government of the best and brightest intellectuals who would define a common good and revitalize America after the Eisenhower years. The media celebrated their brilliance, counting Rhodes Scholars and published books among them. When Vice President Johnson praised these minds, Sam Rayburn responded prophetically, "I'd feel a whole lot better about them if just one of them had run for sheriff once." This highlighted their fatal flaw. They understood theories but lacked practical experience with messy human realities and political limitations. For Secretary of State, Kennedy chose Dean Rusk, not the most brilliant candidate, but the one with fewest objections. Only McGeorge Bundy sensed something second-rate in Rusk. Bundy embodied the team's belief that sheer intelligence and rationality could solve anything. Kennedy spoke of him with awe, "You can't beat brains." Robert McNamara brought similar brilliance to defense, identifying key problems with mathematical precision. His legendary attention to detail inspired both awe and fear. Yet their thinking remained primarily functional, focused on immediate problem-solving rather than long-range perspective. The Bay of Pigs disaster in April 1961 foreshadowed Vietnam through shared elements: misreading non-Western aspirations, misapplying anti-communist ideology, institutional momentum, excessive secrecy, and minimal moral consideration. The invasion's fundamental error was strategic, not tactical, completely misreading Cuban sentiment, where a U.S.-sponsored attack would only strengthen Castro's support. Yet postmortems focused on operational failures rather than questioning the moral legitimacy of the attack. McGeorge Bundy dismissed it as a brick through the window while fixating on execution problems. Surprisingly, this failure intensified rather than tempered the administration's hawkishness. McNamara pushed to expand America's missile arsenal from 450 to 950, despite White House science advisors noting the military equivalence of both numbers. McNamara acknowledged this, but insisted on the higher figure because it was the smallest number we can take up on the Hill without getting murdered. Political appearances trumped strategic reality, another warning sign of the thinking that would drive Vietnam policy. America's early post-war Indochina policy was ambivalent until transformed by the hardening Cold War in Europe and China's Communist Revolution. These events, along with the Korean War and McCarthyism, narrowed acceptable political discourse. Democrats, defensive about losing China, feared appearing soft on communism, political suicide in that climate. By mid-1961, Kennedy was frustrated with conflicting Vietnam intelligence. He distrusted military reports, relied on newspapers, yet criticized journalists covering the region. On November 11, he reached a compromise, sending American advisors and support units but no combat troops. Though Kennedy believed he'd resisted military intervention, increasing American presence from 600 to 15,000 personnel fundamentally altered the commitment. This escalation demanded stronger rhetoric to justify the aid and raised American awareness of Vietnam. Most critically, Kennedy had empowered military leaders who would dominate reporting and continually press for greater commitments. When Johnson became president, he declared firmly, "I am not going to lose Vietnam." Throughout 1964, his administration deliberately downplayed provocations that would later justify escalation, avoiding any sense of crisis. Johnson's desire for congressional backing was fulfilled in late July through the Gulf of Tonkin incident. The groundwork had been laid in January when Johnson authorized covert activities against North Vietnam. On August 2nd, North Vietnamese forces engaged the USS Maddox. A second disputed incident followed on August 4 when the Maddox and C. Turner Joy reported being attacked. Though Johnson later joked, "For all I know, our Navy was shooting at whales out there." The Tonkin resolution passed with only two dissenting votes. McNamara misled Congress about key details and completely omitted the American covert operations that had provoked North Vietnam's response. Had the truth been revealed, Senate hearings would likely have followed, undermining Johnson's position. This pattern of deception, justified as protecting national security, became standard operating procedure. As 1964 ended, Johnson had won the presidency as a peace candidate, yet stood on the brink of war. The administration convinced itself bombing wasn't really war, just a way to prevent using greater force. For McNamara and Deputy McNaughton, avoiding American defeat was the primary motivation, 70%, while containing China, 20%, and helping South Vietnamese, 10%, were secondary concerns. The Rolling Thunder bombing campaign aimed to force North Vietnam to negotiate, but intelligence experts already knew Hanoi wouldn't capitulate to bombing pressure. Just 9 days after authorizing the bombing, General Westmoreland requested Marines to secure the Da Nang Air Base. By early June, after another South Vietnamese defeat, Westmoreland requested 35 battalions immediately, with 9 more potentially needed later. When asked if these would suffice, he admitted further forces would be needed in 1966 and beyond. The die was cast. America was now fighting its own war in Vietnam. By late July 1965, Johnson announced increasing troops from 75,000 to 125,000, though the actual decision involved committing up to 200,000. When asked if this represented a policy change, Johnson falsely claimed it did not, despite transforming a South Vietnamese war into primarily an American one. The consensus supporting the Vietnam War was built on deception. Johnson kept decisions vague to protect his domestic agenda, while Congress was barely consulted. American officials falsely claimed North Vietnam escalated first, when in reality, Hanoi only matched the escalation after American combat troops arrived in 1965. By late 1965, Washington's civilian leaders had unwittingly lost control to Hanoi's Politburo and Westmoreland in Saigon. An endless cycle emerged. Westmoreland would receive more troops, and Hanoi would match the escalation. The 1968 Tet Offensive proved pivotal. When fighting shifted from distant jungles to cities, American media documented the enemy's resilience, collapsing both Westmoreland's attrition strategy and Johnson's credibility. These brilliant men, driven by anti-communism and belief in American omnipotence, chose exterior toughness over the courage to tell Americans the truth. Each lost what they valued most: Johnson's Great Society, McNamara's Pentagon control, Bundy's elite authority, and the Democratic Party's standing. Intelligence without wisdom proved most dangerous. Brilliance blinded by its own light led a nation into darkness.